Ready, doctor?
Well, are we on?
Yeah.
We're rolling.
Well, we were having a good time. Should we stop and get serious?
No.
And should we include the audience?
Yeah, let's include the audience.
Oh, good.
Bring them up to speed.
Welcome to New Realities. That was an informal opening with Dr. David Hawkins, Power versus Force, along with many books about understanding energy, understanding as energy. That interview was done, I think it was about 2003. Never before heard here. This program is sponsored by Portal to Ascension, portaltoascension.org. There's an Ascension conference happening in October in Irvine. Go to ascensionconference.com. That involves UFOs, ancient civilizations, evolution, consciousness, awakening. I'll be there. Grant Cameron will be there. Robert Shaw, many of the people within the disclosure consciousness movement will be attending this conference. So I'll be right back with David Hawkins after this music from Duke Williams and The Night Before the Future.
Just go way back and take it away. Just remember the things you see might not quite be your own reality.
I'm talking to Dr. David Hawkins. He's an MD.
MD, PhD.
PhD.
And
MD.
And he's been knighted. Don't forget, sir.
Oh, you've been knighted?
Well, my real title in the East, they call me Sir Doctor Doctor.
Sir Doctor Doctor.
Yes, because I was knighted by the crown, of the Danish crown.
You were.
Plus, I have two doctorates.
Oh.
So in the East, they call me Sir Doctor Doctor.
Sir Doctor Doctor.
Isn't that neat?
Yeah, I mean.
That's the first Sir Doctor Doctor you've interviewed.
Yeah, well.
Well, that's right. You probably haven't had any Sir Doctor Doctors before.
Welcome to New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld, and on this program, I'd like to talk about consciousness, the evolution of spirituality, and who we are as an evolving race of human beings looking for enlightenment, I would say, looking for an expansion of their own personal consciousness into a greater mind. Tonight's guest is someone who's investigated these fields, who's written three books and more on the subject. He's Dr. David Hawkins, MD, PhD, knighted doctor, and I'd say authority on consciousness.
That's what they say.
That's what they would say. He's the author of Power versus Force, which really put him on the map. And then there was The Eye of the Eye, and his latest is Eye, Reality, and Subjectivity. Thank you, Dr. Hawkins.
That's fun to be here, yes.
Your investigations go into the field of what is consciousness and the measurements of consciousness, but how do you define consciousness to begin with?
It's the infinite field that is the matrix out of which all experience arises, mm-hmm. The very basis of subjectivity. The only reason we know that we're here talking is because subjectively we're aware of it, mm-hmm. And we're aware of it subjectively because we're conscious, and that so we share access to a field of consciousness.
Right, but then it becomes individualized as the I, you know, this field of consciousness.
Each of us thinks it's uniquely ourselves.
But because it's filtered through this little vessel of a perception, right?
Then we call that me.
Right.
I.
Right.
Personal self.
Right.
The book is how to transcend it, the realization that it's not just personal, that it's the ultimate infinite source of all existence, frankly.
This little me is the ultimate source of all existence.
Well, the illusion that you're limited.
Right.
That you're limited. Little I. Whereas actually the awareness of your little I is coming from the big I, which includes the subjectivity of all of mankind, of all of life.
But know. In your books and lectures, you talk about how the mind then, though, intercepts that little I and thinks it's in control.
Yeah, it gives it content and form, and then we label it me.
The mind we label me, but the mind in some people's that I've met, say the mind is the illusion of the me.
It's limited to a personalization.
Mm.
Whereas actually we've personalized the general and then call the personalized section me. See,
And the mind, though, is when you're in your lecture, you said only 1% of the totality of this consciousness.
That's true. The mind is 99% silent. Only 1% is talking.
And that 1% has hypnotized the...
We call that me. I.
So there's really no difference between me and you.
Mm-hmm. I have a personalized section of it, and you have a personalized section
right.
of it. See, that part is unique. But the generality, the reason we understand each other is because we share a commonality called consciousness.
Mm.
Otherwise, there'd be no understanding between us. Mm-hmm.
And you've also talked about how we've demonized the ego into being something, you know, to reject and push away. But it's really part of our conscious evolution back to this great mind.
If you track the evolution of consciousness on this planet,
mm-hmm.
it started millennia ago, and yesterday we gave a lecture on the subject.
Yeah.
We pointed out how it started out really with the bacteria were the first conscious entities on this planet.
Right.
And then on up through the animal kingdom to hominids, Neanderthal man, and mm-hmm. Cro-Magnon man.
And each level is an expansion of this consciousness.
Greater and greater awareness.
Back mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. the awareness of where it began. Would you say?
I track where it originated so that we get to understand what the ego is and how we should positionalize ourselves about it.
Well, where
we should look at it.
Well, how should mm-hmm. we look at the ego? I mean, it's not something to reject because people who haven't a strong ego development never get to dissolve the ego. That's my understanding.
That's one theory that
yeah.
you have to first develop an ego in order to get rid of it.
Exactly. Is that not true?
In a way, it's true, yes. Yeah.
But, you know, in your own process, you know, you talked about your experience. There was a point where you were an atheist. Well, you had some revelations younger, and then you were an atheist, and then you sort of come full circle. What exactly happened? What was the thing that ignited that conscious awareness that you were not this limited being, but something greater?
You know, since I was 3 years old, there was a focus, almost an obsession, about discerning what is truth and what is the nature of truth. It started out with a rather major kind of what people would call spiritual realizations mm-hmm. and confrontations. And that led me into like a drivenness to discover what is the core, the essence of truth.
Well, what were the spiritual revelations that happened?
Well, at age 3, that was a rather astonishing one. You know, as I said, prior to age 3, there was nothing but oblivion. And then suddenly at age 3, it was somebody turned on the Klieg lights, like you're in the dark, see?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden these lights come on, and I suddenly realized I exist.
As a self-referential kind of being.
Well, there was not even a personal self. There was just an awareness of existence mm-hmm. as a stunning reality, mm-hmm. prior to which there was no awareness of existence. So suddenly I'm confronted with existence as such, mm-hmm. which was not pleasing.
It wasn't?
No, because with non-existence, you have, frankly, nothing to worry about. With existence, instantly, the first fear came up. If you exist, the possibility would have been that you might not have come into existence. This was all nonverbal. At age 3, I had no such words. But there was a complete awareness that I exist. Consequently, it could have come about that I would not have come into existence.
Right.
So the first confrontation was, is the ultimate reality existence or non-existence?
Mm.
You know, did the Buddha... You know,
but the fact that you did exist proved existence in a sense, you know. Don't you think things are what they are, and the ideas of hypothesizing that they could have been is also the creation of the mind?
That was the immediate contrary.
Yeah.
So
right.
It was the polarity
yeah.
of existence versus non-existence.
Right, okay.
And of course everybody fears that in the form of death.
Right.
They think that if I die, I will no longer exist because they identify with the body as who they are. So then they fear. So everybody lives with a fear of death.
Right.
You know?
Instead mm-hmm. of identifying with consciousness, which is infinite.
Which is beyond death, right. But unless mm-hmm. one goes through certain experiences, that is not apparent at all.
But as you progress from 3 with that kind of, then what was the next phase?
then the sense of self would tend to disappear from an individual personal self into sort of a universality.
Uh-huh.
And I would be in third grade, you know, and I would be sitting in the chair, and I would remind myself that I am David and I am sitting in this chair, that I'm just me, you know, because the self would just become like universal.
You mean if you didn't remind yourself?
I would preoccupy myself with you know, reminding myself that I'm an individual person and my name is David and I'm sitting here in this chair and I'm doing spelling. See?
Right. I know. I often have to remind myself of my name because it's just a label of identification for response, right?
That's why your consciousness is moving beyond the ordinary.
Well, I hope so. So you keep reminding yourself you're David and you're sitting in the chair.
Well, I was doing this in grade school, yes.
Right. Right. Because then there was a place where you rejected it all when you got into science.
Well, before that, when I was a paper boy in Wisconsin out in the blizzard, to get out of the blizzard after dark, I climbed into a snowbank to get away from the terrible wind, 10 below zero, and pitch black.
Uh-huh.
And I was on the country, no lights, no houses. There you are by yourself in the blizzard. And the only concern was getting away from the wind. So I dug a hole in the snowbank.
Huh.
And sat out of the wind.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, the most exquisite, like you were melted by an infinite love of infinite power, like dissolved. You're dissolved and outside of time and space. And just this infinite presence. The presence was not different than the core and essence of that which I am.
Mm.
It was also beyond time. So I realized that which I am existed before all universes and will continue on after all universes have gone. And this condition was beyond time. So you actually experience it like through the eons.
Hmm.
You're already beyond all time and space. So, and all that's nonverbal, but it's stunningly aware. So that was the first experience of what spiritually is called the self with a capital S.
Or the transcendence.
At the time, I'd never heard of it.
And how old were you?
Oh, 12, 14, 13.
And that experience never left you. I mean, how could it, right?
Well, it leaves a profound imprint, a profound knowingness.
Mm-hmm.
So anything less than that is not of the same rank.
but then you progress to be a doctor and study and kind of stuff your consciousness back into your
body.
Well,
then I really researched the nature of the unconscious, in others and then in myself in 4 years of psychoanalysis, professor, a training analyst from Columbia University, So Freud's really my great-grandfather. Freud analyzed Gardner, who analyzed Debussy, who analyzed me. So my great-grandfather is Freud.
Yeah, and Freud was a great genius, but But he stopped his theories when it got beyond the personal self. It didn't. He couldn't go into the place Jung went.
He didn't go where Jung went.
And so there was a limitation.
But he discovered the profound importance of the unconscious, and of course we now all just accept that. You know, it was a novel idea, turn of the century, but now everybody accepts that we have an unconscious, and that it plays a big part in our life.
And the unconscious, is now, I think, in the place we are evolutionary-wise, is going into this spiritual awareness. So the unconscious and the spirit are kind of merging.
Yeah, so Jung went further than Freud. So Freud calibrated at 499 and Jung calibrated at 520.
Well, I don't think people know what calibration is.
Well, that's just between you and I. We won't tell anybody.
Okay. No, but as far as your process, like once you kind of had that experience at 12, then you tried to understand the unconscious, but you started to close down.
Well, I was brought up very religiously. I was a
Christian.
Episcopalian, high Episcopalian, and I was a boy soprano, an acolyte, etc. And I was quite religious, in fact, scrupulosity almost. And one time I was out in the woods by myself, and which I forgot to talk about in the lecture at all, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, came a comprehension of the totality of the suffering of all of mankind throughout all of time. Mm-hmm. I wasn't thinking about it. I was just walking through the woods, and suddenly I saw the totality of all of the suffering of all of mankind through all of time.
Mm-hmm. And you felt that as well.
It was, you know, a realization. Mm-hmm. And in that instant, I became an atheist.
Really?
I said I couldn't, because God in that time was considered to be the creator of everything. Mm-hmm. When I saw the totality of the suffering of mankind, I said, I cannot believe in a God that would have created that. And I instantly became an atheist. Mm-hmm. And now I became an intense atheist to the same degree I'd been an intense religionist. Mm-hmm. And I became a militant atheist, you know. And then later went on to a Jesuit university where I'm getting straight A's in theology and metaphysics and all this.
Because you couldn't believe God would create that much suffering.
That's right. So okay. I held, well, that's not an uncommon misconception.
Step. Yeah.
Many an atheist becomes an atheist because he holds God responsible for the suffering of mankind. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how would you get beyond that then? I mean, what was the trigger?
Lucky to get...
No, many people don't.
No, I was a very intense atheist, probably 20 years.
You know? It also makes them miserable as well, mm-hmm. to think those thoughts.
No, because it was great to get rid of religion, because uh-huh. sin and guilt went with it.
Uh-huh.
Goodbye, sin and guilt. I was a free agent.
So you said there's so much suffering. No, I don't want to take on the responsibility. It's too much. And that God mm-hmm. could never have mm-hmm. created this this world full of that. So, but how did you resolve it? What was your next step? So
well, I became an atheist. I was angry at God because if God, there was a God, he created all this suffering.
Right.
I didn't want anything to do with him. So I disconnected from him mm-hmm. and became an atheist. So there isn't any God, see? So then I was an intense atheist for many years. And then... became involved in continuous search into the truth of reality, and by then I'd been psychoanalyzed. So I was looking within, for the source of the sense of existence itself. Mm-hmm. And I went into it. I dove into the unconscious, and I went. It was sort of like Dante's hell. I went in deeper and deeper levels. And eventually felt complete abandonment. And I researched, I really ended up in the depths of hell. Mm. And I don't know how Dante understood hell.
I mean, alone and isolated and shut off, is that what the
feeling
was?
Well, no, the top level of hell is torture and, you know, people being dismembered and crap. What usually people think of as hell, mm-hmm. which is jacks for openers. That's just torture and horror.
Right.
Then it begins to get bad.
What?
Really?
What is?
Then what horror really means, all of a sudden you become almost that out of which horror arises. Hmm. And then you enter the level of despair. And then you start going into the lower depths of hell, which are not really describable. Although I think Dante understood it, because... there's an absolute aloneness that is forever. Mm. It's the foreverness and the agony of absolute aloneness. You're like cut off from God completely. And there's like a knowingness as you go beyond to the lower depths of hell. It's almost like a sign that says, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. I don't know how Dante knew that, but by God, there's like a sign there. A knowingness. Beyond this, there is no hope ever. And now you understand what eternity means, mm. that you're hopeless through all eternity and there is no recourse possible. Mm. It's dread and it's timeless. Mm. Just like the highest levels are timeless, the lowest levels are timeless. And the timelessness of forever dread, a voice within said, if there is a God, I ask him to help me. Mm. And then came oblivion. And after the oblivion cleared, I don't know how long it was there, hours or a day or
but
whatever.
There was a surrender into that place.
No surrender.
It wasn't a fight. It was just an acceptance.
It's hopelessness. There's nothing with which to fight or to avoid. The hope is abandoned. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's neither hope nor will there ever be any relief from mm-hmm. endless agony forever. forever agony, with no hope ever. Anyway, the voice, a voice within, said, if there is a God, I ask him for help. And then everything went blank. Then came an awakening, a return of consciousness, and the mind had become silent. This instant, the mind is still silent. And it was replaced by a brilliant revelation of the divinity of all that exists. You know?
How do you describe divinity in that way? I mean,
the totality, the allness of that which is, reveals itself as a oneness, but with a radiance. It's like you can see green, but with LSD, the green now shines forth. It was like a shining forth, the obvious divinity of all that exists, you know? And it was stunning and incapacitating, and therefore, not long after I frankly left the world, at that time I had the largest psychiatric practice in the United States. I had 50 people working for me in research laboratories and all. And a very elegant lifestyle, about as elegant as you can get, frankly. And I walked away from it all. And spent some years in solitude as to how to refunction in the world.
Because was this a continuous of feeling, this divinity, or was it a momentary?
The overwhelm of the revelation slowly calmed down to the point that you could function. But it took some years, and even now it's not perfectly adjusted, especially where the body is in space and things.
But you don't want it to. I mean, isn't the idea of existence to live in that world of divine revelation or divinity with a foot in this world as well? I mean.
Oh, that's an intellectual concept. Subjectively, it isn't that way. Subjectively, there's no interest in the body, eating. All the bodily functions sort of cease, either that or you lose your awareness of them. And there's a certain degree of learning how to be in the world again, frankly.
And this is where you are now?
I've relearned how to be in the world to a fairly good degree, and where the body is. And you see, when you're no longer the body, you see people talking to this body, and you wonder, who are they talking to? I mean, I'm not there. You can see, oh, they all think that you're that. And so then you got to reconnect in a way that's really hard to describe.
Yeah, I've had senses of that. So you feel like you're not this. You're this awareness that encompasses both and all. And
it's not even that. It's none of that. It's because you're none of that. That's the difficulty.
I guess there's no way to talk. I'm trying to intellectually.
I understand what you're saying. You're trying to get a description of what it was like.
I guess there's no way to describe. You have to have the experience. You have to, you know. It's not even an experience, is it? Because the experience is still filtered through the me.
Yes, but we're trying to describe, you know, a phenomena that's rather rare in history and has been described periodically. It's only described with some difficulty. You can only get an approximation to it, you know.
And it still doesn't give people the experience of it. I mean, to the uninitiated, it wouldn't mean anything really, right? Because, I mean,
it's people are curious about it, so they ask about it because of curiosity, you know.
So where are you now? You've had
that. What's the implication for them? That's the real importance.
Well, it plants a seed, probably, for that. Like, say, there might be something that they might go through or realize at some point that will match this decision.
Well, the process is called relinquishing the ego, the progressive relinquishment of the ego, for determination of identifying oneself as the mind and its intellectual functioning. So at that point, you're no longer the body, you're no longer the mind. nor are you limited in time or space, which is hard to describe.
Yeah, and also you talk about in these books.
But we've done a good job of describing it.
But the fact that the mind creates continuity, that, you know, these thoughts have a continuous sequence, and you saying that's also an illusion because each thing arises separately.
And the world looks to the average human mind like a world of causality,
right.
A Newtonian paradigm, where there's a this that causes a that. And as we tried to explain, it doesn't really work that way. What happens is that a potentiality becomes an actuality, and that is witnessed sequentially, and therefore you think there's causality in the world. Causality is in the mind. Mm-hmm. So the most important thing I try to teach in transcending the identification with the ego and the mind is the difference between what Descartes calls res interna, that is that of the mind, mm-hmm. and res externa, that of the world. Mm. And the illusion is that one thinks that what one sees in the mind, then they project it on the world and they think that that's in the world.
They think it's real.
All right, so causality makes sense to the mind. Mm-hmm. So it presumes, therefore, that it's out there. Mm. It's a presumption. The out there has no concepts. So causality couldn't be out there because that's only a concept which can only exist in your head.
But there is something out here, mm-hmm. right? There is a world that we are interacting with.
There very definitely is, yes.
But what is that world? There's no way to know it.
Well, we don't really know it except by our subjective experience of its phenomena. So we are processing... You know, sequences of phenomena, that's what our mind is doing all the time.
And what's the point of that if that's an illusion? What is the point of...
Not necessarily an illusion, because the subjective reality is a subjective reality, and there's an external reality that's also an external reality.
But it seems like the subjective reality is the illusion, the fact that there's a me and a you, a personal... That's
a presumption. Presumption. So what we try to do is transcend the presumptions of the mind and the presumptions of the mind to come about because of the structure of the ego. Mm-hmm. So what we try to do is go back in time and see how did the ego arise. Mm-hmm. And we see that the field of consciousness itself is infinitely powerful. And when it interacted with matter on this planet, out of that arose life. Mm-hmm. So life arose out of the infinite field of consciousness itself, which alone has the sufficient power. Huh?
But you could say infinite field of consciousness. You can also say God. Now, I like infinite field better, but people have said God, right?
Because God, for the same reason that Buddha said, it's better not to mention God, because people have all kinds of conceptions about God. But consciousness sounds more, a little safer to discuss.
Yeah, okay.
See?
Yeah.
And, of course, then you see the evolution of consciousness up through the animal kingdom. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In fact, you can calibrate the energy, the calibrated levels of consciousness throughout the animal kingdom.
So the infinite awareness...
And then awareness, it comes out as man. And then we eventually come up to man.
And right? As we head back to the infinite consciousness. So man is the bridge from the spark of life back to the infinite consciousness.
He becomes the bridge, yes.
Yeah. And it comes full circle then.
So then he has this protoplasm and a body.
Right.
And he has an animal brain and animal instincts. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis of the structure of the ego.
Is the animal side of
it. Yeah, that's the beginning of it. Right. And we share many things with the animal. Territoriality and,
food,
survival. And then on top of being an animal... Mm-hmm. We develop a prefrontal cortex. Uh-oh. We were doing okay till we got a prefrontal cortex. Now,
what did that do for us?
Now, up here, you have the capacity of the angelic, the awareness of spiritual reality. And in the back of the brain, you're still an animal. Mm-hmm. So man has the unenviable position of having the instincts of the animal and the forebrain of the angel. And so his life is very, very difficult. very, very difficult. The task of the human being is to evolve from being dominated by the instinctual animal, and then the thinkingness of the prefrontal cortex, and then moving on to that, to spiritual awareness. So it's quite a project.
So the frontal cortex is where the consciousness itself can be realized.
Yeah, where we, that's infinite, where we process things, you know.
The infinite can be somehow held in thought, in the prefrontal.
So you see, when the prefrontal cortex is put there, the old animal brain was not removed. Then we wouldn't have any problem. No, the animal brain is there, and now you add the prefrontal cortex. And then to make it up to consciousness level 200 or so, you just have the physical prefrontal cortex. And then as you start to become spiritually awakened, there's the release of what tradition has been called, let's say, the kundalini energy, the spiritual energy. Now changes the way the brain functions, and you develop, beside the protoplasmic physical brain, an energy brain called the etheric brain. The etheric brain is more like an energy field. And now
you can,
the spiritualized person actually processes things differently. Their brain processes things differently. They see things differently. They experience them differently.
Because they can tap into something beyond the physical with this etheric brain.
The etheric brain does it for them. So a person that calibrates below 200, let's say, on a scale of consciousness, and a person who calibrates above will have two different experiences of the same phenomena.
Right.
And she'll say, wasn't it awful? And he'll say, gee, that was pretty nice, wasn't it? It was the same experience, but subjectively, to one it was awful, to the other it was entertaining.
Well, we should talk about how you've mapped consciousness from the bacteria up into the most...
That was the thrust of the first book.
Yeah,
was
the power versus force.
We discovered how to calibrate the level of the consciousness.
Right.
For the first time in human history, we knew the difference between truth and falsehood.
And how did we know this?
Well, the thrust of the impact of the work was that man is, because of the structure of the ego, man has never had the capacity to discern truth from falsehood. Then we discovered through a certain easy-to-learn technique called kinesiology that the field of consciousness instantly recognizes truth from falsehood. So,
but kinesiology has been proven not to be 100% accurate.
With what?
With people doing the testing, the muscle testing, right? I mean, it's influenced by the tester and the testee.
If people don't know how to do it, if you do it correctly, then you have no personal interest in the matter.
Right.
You have no personal position. You're just using it like litmus paper. You know, red is acid, blue is base, alkaline.
So through this technique, you were able to then map truth?
Anyway, what we did is we created a scale of 1 to 1,000 relative degrees of truth. And that which is more or less above 200 is true, and that which is under 200 is not true.
True.
And it's impersonal.
But how do you define true?
Oh, that's what the whole book's about, Man's never been able to define what is truth.
Yeah, how do you?
Because truth is content, but it's only true within a certain context.
Right.
So one reason truth has never been agreed upon is because it's not possible to discern truth unless you state in what context. So we define truth really differently than it's ever been, because truth is content within a certain context, within an overall context of the field of consciousness itself. So the technique we use is tapping an absolute. The field of consciousness itself is an absolute, it is not a variable. So you have to discover some absolute.
So what would the absolute be? What would
the absolute would be the field of consciousness itself, which innately has the capacity to discern truth from falsehood. Much like an electrostatic condenser. The electrostatic condenser just stands there. It does nothing. It has a potential. When you bring an opposite charge up to it, it crackles, it recognizes it. When you take it away, it disappears. So it is a, you might say, this field is the absolute. It does nothing except be, and then it will only respond to what is presented to it to the degree of the intensity of the stimulus.
And that's what consciousness is, responding to the stimulus of creation.
That's what it does, yeah. It's a clean field, clear field.
So you map the whole scale of consciousness.
All possibility within this domain.
And then you found that the most realized beings registered at 1,000, like
1,000,
Jesus, Buddha, and most of human society is below 200, which is
in America, it's 50-50. 50-50. The calibrated level of consciousness in America, America calibrates at 421.
421.
And 50, that's extremely high. It's the highest country in the world. As far as calibrated level consciousness.
Is that because people have gone beyond survival here and they have achieved a level of spiritual pursuit?
Well, the 400s, calibrated levels of the 400s, are the intellect. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, what we consider normal, our normal world is rational. Mm-hmm. Rational, sensible, logical. Mm-hmm. It follows the rules of logic. Mm-hmm. And it's educated. It's really quite sophisticated.
That's our world. Let's start from 0 to 100. We just it's basically animal nature. Survival.
That would be very rudimentary. Yeah.
Yeah. And so then from 100 to 200 is the
more energy. So the increase of energy as you go up. Mm-hmm. So below 200 we call it force, because force has an opposite.
Right.
And from 200 up is power. Mm-hmm. So
power doesn't have an opposite. It's power.
Power doesn't have an opposite.
Like
see,
you said, so, like light. It's
So the power as the consciousness field goes up, the power goes up logarithmically. Mm-hmm. So 15% in the world overall, 15% calibrate from 200 and up, and 85% 200 and down. And the reason the world doesn't self-destruct is because the 15%. The power is so enormous that they totally counterbalance the 85%.
So how would one raise their level of consciousness?
That's what all spiritual work is about. You know, to choose to forgive rather than to condemn, to understand rather than to vilify, to be compassionate towards all of life. And eventually, if you're compassionate towards all of life, one day as you're not expecting it, suddenly see the sacredness of all of life. Mm. Now, below consciousness level 200, sacredness of all of life doesn't make any sense at all. And for in the 400s, it would be a concept. But as you move to consciousness levels 500 and up, it becomes a radiant obviousness. All of life is sacred.
But that's why there's been so much war on this planet, because people haven't recognized the sacredness of life. They've been below this level.
That's true. And interestingly, you know, in all of human history, the world has been at peace only 7% of the time.
93% of the time we've been at war.
93% of human history, the world has been at some kind of war.
So why do we live in this strata of consciousness? Why can't we all live in this peaceful world? There must be a purpose for existence creating this large venue of interactions.
Well, we see it as a stratified level of evolution. Yeah. The evolution of consciousness takes us right from through the insect world, really, on up through the animal world, up through the average human, up to the enlightened human, angels and the saints.
But will it always be that stratified? Will we ever start to live in a world that's in peace? Or is the purpose of existence to live in the strat?
Well, there's the celestial realms, and then there's the earthly realms. This is not a celestial realm, right?
No, but it could be. Yeah. It could be. It's possible for us to live in
7% of the time, at least, it gives up war.
But we're evolving as a conscious race.
That seems to be the purpose, is sort of a karmic evolution of consciousness. And as the Buddha, the Buddha said that. And what you choose will decide what the fate is after you leave the body.
But that goes against sort of what you were saying about things arising spontaneously, this karmic evolutionary thing.
Well, that's only what you witness as phenomena within the material world.
But things have an evolution to them.
So all of life is really evolutionary.
Yeah.
And how we witness it then depends on the degree to which we transcended the ego, how we interpret it. Like we say, Well, the animal kills. The animal doesn't kill. The animal just eats.
Right.
So we interpret it from a human viewpoint. Oh, bad animal, bad lion kills poor rabbit. But if with consciousness research, we ask, does the animal, does the lion actually want to kill the rabbit? We get no. What does the lion want? The lion wants to eat lunch. And that's the only way we know he knows how to eat lunch.
But what so is
because he doesn't have enough energy. He has to get energy out there.
But so. What is the overall purpose of existence? If we're evolving back to the consciousness that created life, what was the point of it all to begin with?
That is beyond comprehension.
But do you have a sense? Do you have feeling?
The sense is that consciousness was impersonal, didn't have any kind of program, and it spontaneously evolves over the eons to higher and higher transcendence until it finally realizes it, the reality of its own source.
And then coming back.
It spontaneously does that, just like water seeks its own level.
And then we're back at that oneness where we began.
Then you transcend the identification with limitation.
But it's so nice, the illusion is so pleasurable, and the reality is, you don't think so.
A great deal of the time it is, yes.
Yeah, and yes. So there must be a way of keeping that expanded consciousness and the individuality with the awareness that we're not that. You know, there's a way of walking in two worlds.
Yeah. That is a relatively advanced level of consciousness.
And well, this is where we're headed.
85% of the people in the world would not agree with you.
So there's no way to deal with people at these levels of 200 who want to make war except to let them play out their, their levels.
Well, everyone tries to uplift the total awareness of mankind. And I always say all the people who pray and through acts of goodwill and good works tend to lift the overall level of consciousness. And by doing that, they lift all the ships on the sea. So what can we do for people who have less? If we raise the level of conscious awareness itself, it has a positive impact,
And this is what the purpose of consciousness then does.
That's the purpose of prayer and peace vigils and all these things.
So what's the next step for you? Where are you heading?
What I'm doing is finishing a book in which we use a technique to tell the calibrated level of consciousness of things, the degree of truth. What really calibrating is the degree of truth. And then we use these calibrated levels of consciousness to examine everything in the world, all the movies, all the places on the planet, from Machu Picchu to the...
Well, what are some of the high places you found?
Well, this trip we did the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, did St. Thomas's Cathedral, we did Fifth Avenue, we did the Empire State Building, the Statue of Liberty.
What registers really high on this level of truth? What are some of the high points?
Yeah, in New York City?
In New York City and around the world.
Around the world, yeah. Well, we did the cathedrals around the world.
What are some of the high points around the world?
Frankly, the great cathedrals really calibrate generally, the higher than anything else.
More than the pyramids in Egypt?
Yes.
Really?
The great cathedrals of the world really, as a locality, calibrate higher than any other place.
How's St. John the Divine calibrate?
Oh, well, it's over 6'10". Extremely high. High.
What was another high cathedral?
St. Thomas, Chartres Cathedral in France, Notre Dame.
So is there a...
So the great cathedrals, oddly, they calibrate higher than... And energy than any other objects or localities,
So is there a radiance or a reflection that happens when you're sitting in these places that help uplift our vibration?
I think, well, it comes about as a result of intention. It's the intention behind it, plus maybe 1,000 years it takes to build, over a couple of centuries to build some of
the... If we're sitting in these places, there must be that intentionality reflecting on our field.
The energy field of those places is uplifting, so that's why people go to church and all to feel uplifted. But any place that has great beauty, I think Central Park, we didn't calibrate Central Park, but going through there yesterday, the obvious intention and the intention of the preserving and reflecting the beauty of nature, you know, creation, the beauty of creation through the beauty of nature.
So it's all about uplifting.
All those things are uplifting, yes.
Uplifting, as opposed to the things that are not uplifting, which would be what?
Things that are demeaning, things that play off the lowest impulses of man.
Like war and...
And war, let's say gangster rap, you know, gangster rap, in other words, to exploit the downside of man, sensationalism.
And places, are there places that are down as well? I guess you can feel it.
You
can feel
you can tell down places, yes.
But isn't part of that the illusion to love everything and to see it all as divine?
Well, how one relates to that is personal. But what it is impersonal. So
you're measuring the impersonal response to truth that exists.
So what that reflects about society, it would be the downside. So on a calibrated level of consciousness, there's also the downside. What does the downside look like? The downside looks like cruelty, lascivious exploitation of sexuality, indifference to the rights of others, you know, violating other people's boundaries.
So as a conscious society, of course,
murder.
Sure, that's never been a good one. So we're evolving towards this place of not morality, but a decency.
We could call it just an aesthetic awareness. So as you become more evolved, things become distasteful because they're just totally foreign. So an evolved person doesn't need laws to not rob and kill and steal and murder. Unevolved person really needs those, really needs to know it's against the law.
Yeah.
They do.
But but I've always hoped to live in an enlightened society. I mean, that's
well, 421 is a pretty enlightened society. It's very concerned with ethics and morality, current events, the ethics and morality of everything. Movies, it's so morality and ethics are really very central to the American discourse.
And to move
about
beyond
everything.
Yeah. And can you calibrate the future, where we're heading? Can you calibrate?
No, the future you can't calibrate.
Why is that?
Because it doesn't have any existence. So the fuel of consciousness, as I said, is like an electrostatic field. It can only respond to what is. And it cannot respond to what is not.
But yet there's a place beyond time as well. So timelessness is, the future takes place within a linear thing, but there's a timeless place as well. This is what I'm trying to understand.
The substrate of all of existence is timeless.
I keep thinking
and
the future...
And time is a track that we superimpose and project onto it.
I hope that the future is moving into the timeless, but that's also part of the illusion of the mind.
Well, it's already in the timeless. In fact, the present is in the timeless. Time is only a track within the head, and one thing that happens when you escape the ego is the instant stop of time. So the states I went into are all timeless states, and then you get reoriented to the world and you learn how to time track it again. But frankly, you live timelessly.
So you're living in a timeless place.
In actuality, yeah.
When you...
But I've learned how to time track it.
So you still hold on to your personality somehow.
With effort.
But, and then you're mostly...
By myself, I let it all go.
By yourself, what happens?
All that disappears.
Where are you?
One is just sort of timeless existence.
And there's no you?
No, there's no personal you. But you, when you interact with people, you readopt a persona.
Is it possible to exist without the personal, without the persona?
That's the reality. That's the reality that's going on all the time. That's the reality underneath it all. Yeah.
Because it's the persona that creates the problems.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
So we could exist just being, without persona.
Well, actually, we're doing that right now.
We are. All right.
But we don't want to sound strange to the world, so.
We're all doing it, though, right?
Yeah, that's so, true. We're all doing that.
And it's just this kind of, many people are very attached to their personas.
Yeah, they are. And the body.
And they've identified.
And their mind.
Yeah, I like
and,
what you...
And thinkingness.
And thinking. I personally love thinking. I get pleasure
well,
from
I'm,
thinking.
Well, that's good. That's
no,
fine.
But it's also part of that illusion.
No, you should get pleasure out of everything. That's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, but there's a part
Some
of
Some people get pleasure out of misery.
Yeah.
They love it.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
After lecture, you know, people come up, and they got endless misery and misery. Mm. You think, you could have let that go 30 years ago.
And why don't people, how do you let it go and why don't they?
Going on to
yeah.
When you let go wanting to hang on to it,
yeah.
Because the ego gets satisfaction out of it.
Yeah.
So when you relinquish the, willing to relinquish the satisfaction, you get out of rehashing something that happened 30 years ago, then you disappear it. Mm-hmm. But as long as you're getting juice out of it, living off of it.
Right. So you've made a great bridge from the psychological to the divine. Like you have, you've kind of spanned those worlds. But
from the Newtonian.
Yeah. How do we make that? How does the world make that bridge? Because people are locked into their psychology. They don't see this other level. And
I think all the people that are interested in spiritual work all have the same intention, to transcend the identification with the mind or the body. To realize the universal self, you might say. Mm-hmm. So they're all united in that. They're all trying to move, you know, to the awareness of divinity.
But that doesn't happen. It didn't happen to Freud. It doesn't happen until you have it, until you have a revelation.
Well, in this lifetime, Freud moved up to consciousness level 499, as did Einstein and Sir Isaac Newton.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pushing the intellect to see how far can you go with the intellect as a tool in understanding absolute reality. Mm-hmm. So
but you can only go so far.
Well, the intellect, if you calibrate it, you know, is the 400s.
Right.
And at 499, you move to 500, and 500 is love. Then you enter the realm of love as the ultimate important reality.
Uh-huh.
Now you're in a different paradigm.
Right.
Now you're in a different paradigm. Now, the yardstick is the degree to which something is loving, nurturing, beautiful, sacred. Now you have a whole different yardstick.
But there's a huge jump from 499 to 500.
It's a paradigm jump.
You just have to jump.
It's a jump to the subjective.
Yeah.
So in the 400s, you're concerned with without there-ness.
Yeah.
At 500, suddenly you realize, I don't live out there. I live within my own subjective awareness. Now, the quality of subjective awareness transcends the importance of what's out there.
Right.
And what's out there is relatively important, except to the degree that it reflects or enhances the subjective exquisiteness of life. So going through Central Park was beautiful because the aesthetic, you see the value of the aesthetic. And I thought, there were children playing there, you know, and I thought, now without Central Park, they would not have access to the aesthetics of the surroundings, the love of nature, the appreciation of beauty and flowers and joy. Huh?
Yeah, no, joy. Yeah. And we bring that all in to modify the illusion, to uplift the level of consciousness. We bring this aesthetics in so we can...
Well, we increase our awareness of it.
And then we transcend it.
And then for a while, you only experience it within certain settings, you know, certain music, certain settings of nature. And then as consciousness, awareness progresses, you begin to experience it everywhere, all the time. And you pick up anything, you pick up, the people say, that's a natural weed, and you see the incredible beauty, it's like a beautiful piece of sculpture. Because now you see the beauty of everything. That exists, you know. Right. Then you have to learn how to live in the world again, which and how the world sees everything, and so it's an adjustment.
It's a place we're all heading towards.
That's what they say. Then of what use would the world be?
Well, I don't know.
We'd all be in the celestial realm.
Well, yeah.
So we wouldn't be running through this earth life anymore.
Do things happen in your body as well with that revelation? The kundalini, the energy, the
That was quite intense, yes.
What happened in that?
Well, on asked, this exquisite sensation would start running up my spine. Uh-huh. It was like a flow up the spine and up the back. It went on for 5 or 6 years. Uh-huh. And it would flow up into the brain, actually. Mm. And so the pleasure of it was exquisite. Exquisite. And then sometimes the energy would flow down and radiate out into various things happening within the world.
Mm-hmm. Like a
well, like down. Around at a bend in the car, it just turned over, crash. Mm-hmm. And this energy just flowed with this exquisite intensity right into the car. Obviously, people were praying.
Out of you, into the car.
Yes.
You were witnessing it. You weren't doing anything.
I myself did nothing except, and this phenomena would occur in various places. Usually I got the feeling that people were praying and you were like sort of a way station and the energy would come down through you and out to the person praying. And then it would suddenly stop or there would be a fight starting someplace. This energy, one time in Chicago, it's running down the block. I get down the block, I see these two gangs ready to go at each other. Mm-hmm. This energy's flowing right into them. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden you see one side go like this, and the other side go like this, and they both fell back, and the fight stopped, you know. Mm-hmm. This energy did that for 5 or 6 years.
And then it's not happening anymore.
And that slowly faded away. And other phenomena took its place.
Like what? Like,
Were you disappearing?
Were you like... if consciousness, if the time is an illusion, then we could take this moment and be in another place instantly, because this is a creation of the mind.
Right? Hypothetically, that's true.
But in reality...
And that's the way the phenomena occurred. Mm. You know? And this phenomena, things would heal themselves in it. Mm. People would walk in and sit in this field next to me. In fact, it was under the clock. Was it the Biltmore under the clock? Mm. The Biltmore, yeah. Mm. I was sitting there, and there's the clock up there. This lady sits down next to me, and she's ranting and raving. She's got paranoid delusions and aches and pains and all the limping and all this thing. And this energy starts just going over. She's rattling away there, talking to herself, and this energy goes there. After a few minutes, the energy, if they'd save me 5 minutes, the energy slowly comes to a stop, and she stops her ranting. She was having paranoid delusions, ranting about supposed to meet her under the clock. You know, there wasn't no such person.
Right.
And she got up and walked away fine, calm and peaceful, and she walked normally, you know. So it was that energy that did that. Huh. And I was just like an impersonal antenna. But it was the energy that did that. Mm-hmm.
So this is the energy of consciousness interacting with form as we evolve.
It's called spiritual energy. Yeah. Classically, it was called kundalini energy over the ages, you know. Sanskrit.
Thank you, Dr. Hawkins, for sharing your experience.
Yeah.
And giving something to the world.
We were talking about it from somewhat different way than the way I usually present it. We saw it more like how the world would be interested in it. And that's what I was interested in.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, how I lecture about it is the way I see it.
And
you're asking us how the world would want to see it. And that's where it was valuable.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
For me, of course, I want the experience there. That it's intellectual for me, in a sense. Mm-hmm. I'm getting an idea of it, but...
Yeah, well, intention takes you there anyway.
Yeah.
If you handle that intention, then everything that's needed to achieve that comes to you. It's handed to you.
See, the intention for divinity, intention for achieving.
Yeah, your intention.
Yeah.
Will then pull to you all that's required to reach that goal.
Okay. So
you just hang on to the intention, that's all you got to do.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah, I'm talking to Dr. David Hawkins. Author of Power vs. Force, mm-hmm. The Eye of the Eye, and I, reality and subjectivity, an explorer of this world of phenomena. That's what I would call you.
It's like we discovered the microscope. We saw this, we draw pictures of it, so we describe with a new tool now what was not observable throughout history.
Thanks for listening to New Realities. Unfortunately, David Hawkins has passed on, but I'm so happy I was able to present this interview as part of his legacy, part of his teachings for the planet. He was truly a master. You can go to his website, still up, David Hawkins. That's Hawkins, is Hawkins. So thanks for listening. If you want to reach me, email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Check me out on YouTube, youtube.com/newrealities. Look for me at the Ascension Conference, Irvine, California, October 5th, 6th, and 7th. This program has been sponsored by Portal to Ascension. I hope to see everyone at that Portal to Ascension Conference.